Hi, friends. How are we doing? Well, I'm thankful you're here. This morning we continue a series studying the life and the lyrics of David. We're looking at David's journey from the pastures of Bethlehem to the palace in Jerusalem. As we look at David's story, we're reading some of his prayers in the Psalms so we can learn what he's learned. Today we're going to look at three chapters from the book of 2 Samuel, which find David establishing his kingdom in Jerusalem. Before we come to the story, I want to pray. But I want to pray a little differently than I normally pray. Every once in a while, I like to share a well-written prayer with you. Walter Brueggemann is a renowned Old Testament scholar, but he's also known for beginning his lectures with powerful and poetic prayers. The one I'd like to share with you now is from a collection of his prayers in a book called Prayers for a Privileged People. This is a prayer he prayed before reading 1 and 2 Samuel, so I thought it would be appropriate today. Now, I realize as I do this, we all come from different religious backgrounds. And the concept of us praying a written prayer may be a little new to you, and you don't know what to do. So let me say, first, you may simply want to close your eyes, listen, and receive. Or you may want to keep your eyes open, because I'm going to put the words to this prayer on the screen. Yes, God hears prayers even when your eyes are open, which is important if you pray on your daily commute. However you'd like to respond, I hope you join your hearts as we make Dr. Brueggemann's prayer our own. Father, we love to tell the old, old story. We love to sing the old, old song of your saving deeds of mercy and freedom and healing and newness. We know about Exodus freedom and dancing tambourines. We know about land and huge clusters of grapes. We know about rivers of water and rivers of oil. We know about the strangeness that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the dead are raised, the poor rejoice. We know. Give us courage to trust what we know and to obey what we hope. We know that the old, old story in our telling becomes a new, dangerous, transforming song. And so we sing. And God's people declare in agreement, everyone together, amen. My name is Troy, and I'm your pastor. I feel like it's been forever since I've been here. Does it feel like that? In fact, it's just been 2 weeks. Some of you have asked me about my vacation. It is true that there was a little trip tucked in the middle of my absence from teaching. I don't feel like I deserve credit for taking a vacation. Frankly, it ended up being something of a working vacation because of a few projects that I'm working on this summer for our community. In fact, with my wife's blessing, I have worked longer, harder hours in the last 8 weeks than any other season of ministry in my, I don't know how long I've been doing this. It's been difficult, but I will tell you, I think it's been the best summer ever. Not because it's been hard, but because it has been so good. I can tell you this. I have never been more excited about what God is doing in our community than I am right now. As I said, I've been working on a few projects. I'm going to tell you more about those projects in the coming days. For now, I just want to tell you about one of them. I can say, officially, as of just a few days ago, that next month we are going to be bringing onto our Capitol staff our longtime friend, Leif Oines. to help manage ministries and leaders. Now, I know not all of you know Leif by name, but he and his wife have been a part of our community from a distance for the better part of a decade. You see, Leif's wife is our friend Margaret Feinberg. So, a little later this fall, they will actually relocate here to Salt Lake City to live. Margaret's going to continue her ministry at teaching at conferences and churches around the country, but when she's not on the road, she might be sitting next to you. She might be serving you a latte in the cafe. There's no telling with Margaret. But I will tell you, this is one of the most exciting things that I have been able to talk about in a long, long time. Our leadership team and our church board have been praying about this and thinking about this for a long time, and we are absolutely thrilled to see God's provision and God's timing in this season. As I said a moment ago, I have never been more excited about what God is doing in our community than I am today. But man, am I tired. I mean, this week, I think I averaged a good 50 to 60 hours in meetings. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but I'll tell you, my job is a whole lot more than just meetings. If you're wondering when I found time to write a sermon, I didn't. So let's close in prayer. Well, somehow I hope to string a few sentences together, but I'll tell you, there was one day this week when I was especially wiped out. I'd been tied up in meetings day and night for days, away from Sue's, away from the girls, and I just wanted a break, you know, just not a break from work, just an opportunity for just soul rest. Then I get a text from my wife. She asked, "Did you see the new barbecue place in Cottonwood Heights?" It was as if the Lord Almighty texted me himself. He restores my soul. You ever been to Bandit's Grill? Sweet biscuits, friends. This is an answer to prayer. You got to check out this place. As an appetizer, you could get deviled eggs. You could get tri-tip chili. You could get tri-tip nachos, and it's really good tri-tip. Thursdays feature an all-you-can-eat barbecue buffet for $19.99. Now, hear this, all the meat you can eat. Look, I went there once. All I had was a tri-tip sandwich served with onions and peppers on garlic bread, urban garlic french fries, ranch beans made with bacon in the kingdom of heaven. It was brilliant. And here's what I'm asking you to do. You got to go try this restaurant. I don't get any money for this, but the reason I need you to go try this restaurant is I need them to stay in business for the sake of my soul. So if you care about me, we went on Thursday night of this week, and we just loved it. And the food was great, but what was better, there's just something about our family of five. We just love to eat together. We love to eat together because great things always happen around the table in our house. At the table, we laugh together. At the table, we work out our conflict. At the table, we celebrate good days and empathize with bad days. At the table, we enjoy God's provision. Good things happen around the table if you're sitting at the right table. Today I want to tell you, you're invited to the table of the Lord. As we return to David's story, we find him setting up shop in Jerusalem as God's anointed king. God's promise is fulfilled. God did whatever he needed to do to get David where he needed to go. David sits on the throne in Jerusalem, and now he wants to honor God. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 1. After the king was settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies around him, he said to Nathan the prophet, "Here I am, living in a house of cedar, while the ark of God remains in a tent." God's sovereign protection allows David to build a palace, but the ark of God is relegated to a tent, and David wants to do something about it. So he consults with the prophet Nathan, who agrees, "David, you've got a great idea." But God has a better plan. The Lord speaks to Nathan overnight saying, I haven't needed a temple before. I don't need one now. David wants to do something for me, but I want to do something for him. 2 Samuel 7, verse 8. The Lord speaking, now then, tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture, from tending the flock, and appointed you ruler over my people Israel. I have been with you wherever you have gone, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. Now I will make your name great, like the names of the greatest men on earth. God selected David, God raised up David, God appointed David. Eugene Peterson points out this section of chapter 7 boasts 23 verbs, and God is the subject of all of them. God is on the move. God is working for David. He plucked David from the pasture, and now he'll establish David's throne. Look at verse 11. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with a rod wielded by men, with floggings inflicted by human hands. But my love will never be taken away from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. We see in these verses the future of the nation. We see a promise of the Messiah. Oh, David had a plan, but God had a better one. The king responds in humility, verse 18, who am I, sovereign Lord? And what is my family that you have brought me this far? Verse 20, what more can David say to you? For you know your servant, sovereign Lord. See, this is the kind of thing that happens when you're invited to the table of the Lord. At God's table, you get to know him. And as you do, I think you'll find him to be surprisingly generous. No, he doesn't always give you everything you want, but he always gives you more than you need. My father-in-law says to me all the time, you can't outgive God. And he's right. Chapter 7 ends with a promise. Chapter 8 describes how God establishes David's kingdom by conquering his enemies. Verse 1, in the course of time, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. Verse 2, David also defeated the Moabites. Verse 3, moreover, David defeated Hadadezer, son of Rehob, king of Zobah. Verse 5, when the Arameans of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David struck down 22,000 of them. Verse 6, he put garrisons in the Aramean kingdom of Damascus, and the Arameans became subject to him and brought tribute. Now, the key to David's success is revealed in the second half of verse 6. The Lord gave David victory wherever he went. Verse 13, and David became famous after he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. He put garrisons throughout Edom, and all the Edomites became subject to David. How did this happen? Verse 14, the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. You can't outgive God. Now, at the close of chapter 8, David is on top of the world. He has reached the zenith of power. And it's in that season of blessing, David poses a question to his court. Chapter 9, verse 1, David asked, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? You see, for many years, the house of Saul has been the enemy of the house of David. Saul relentlessly sought to kill David. After Saul's death, the house of Saul remained David's mortal enemy. But now David's kingdom is established. And now he looks for any remaining heirs of the old dynasty because he wants to show that person kindness on behalf of Jonathan. In the ancient world, the leader of a new dynasty doesn't show kindness to the descendants of an old dynasty. Every descendant of the old king is just another reason the new king shouldn't be on the throne. So ancient rulers characteristically wiped out every descendant in sight. David, however, seeks to show kindness. Since Saul's death, David's worked to establish and strengthen his claim to power, so it comes as a shock that he does something which might weaken his claim to power. Why does he do it? Well, if you've journeyed with David in our series, you probably remember Jonathan, his best friend. Though Saul desired to kill David, Jonathan, the son of Saul, befriended him. In fact, they made a covenant with one another to look out for one another's interests. Years earlier, as Jonathan's father conspires to kill our young hero, David reminds Jonathan of their covenant. Verse 8, "Show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you before the Lord." Jonathan pledges his commitment to David. But then he reminds David of his obligation. Jonathan says, verse 14, "But show me unfailing kindness, like the Lord's kindness, as long as I live, so that I may not be killed, and do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." Jonathan knows God has given David the throne, and David may be tempted one day to exterminate his entire family and stomp out all rivals to the throne. So Jonathan pleads for mercy on his household. He pleads for an unfailing kindness like the Lord's kindness. Now, the word that Jonathan has used and the word that David has used is the Hebrew word chesed. We don't have a word in English to fully describe it, so translators used a variety of words to capture the idea. Grace, mercy, faithfulness, commitment, loyalty, steadfast love. David used that word in chapter 9, verse 1. "Is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" David searches for anyone who knows anything about Saul's descendants, but it seems that information is largely unknown until David discovers a servant who served the household of Saul. Verse 2, "Now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They summoned him to appear before David, and the king said to him, 'Are you Ziba?' 'At your servant, at your service,' he replied." Verse 3, "The king asked, 'Is there no one still alive from the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness?' Ziba answered the king, 'There is still a son of Jonathan. He is lame in both feet.'" This description grabs our attention. His name isn't mentioned. He's defined by his disability. Of course, there's the backstory. 2 Samuel 4 describes the death of Saul's son Ishbosheth. However, the narrator interrupts the flow of the narrative to insert a parenthetical comment in verse 4. "Jonathan, son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse picked him up and fled, but as she hurried to leave, he fell and became disabled. His name was Mephibosheth." Mephibosheth was born Meribaal, son of Jonathan, the crown prince, grandson of King Saul. From his birth, Mephibosheth was a boy of promise. The firstborn son of the firstborn son of the king was virtually assured the throne. But when he was just 5 years old, word came to the court of Saul that his father Jonathan and his grandfather Saul were slaughtered by the Philistines, who began raiding the cities of Israel. The palace provided no protection to this would-be king, so the household fled for their lives. Mephibosheth's nurse picked him up to save his life, but in her haste, she dropped him. We don't know what happened. It's possible his spine was injured. It's possible his legs were broken and his bones knit together poorly. Whatever the reason, Mephibosheth was never able to walk again. As he grew into manhood, he watched from a distance as David ascended the throne, unseating his family, creating a new royal dynasty. The boy was raised in exile for his own survival. If the new king discovered his existence, surely he'd take his life. Pain, fear, obscurity, and shame, that was the life trajectory of Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan. Now, back to 2 Samuel 9. David inquires of the servant, "Where is he?" Verse 4, the king asked. Ziba answered, "He is at the house of Machir, son of Amiel of Lo Debar. So King David had him brought from Lo Debar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. Now, notice, Ziba has not yet mentioned his name. But was he worth mentioning? In ancient times, disabilities were shameful, often viewed as a curse from God. It's better to keep that which is disgraceful out of sight. Verse 6, When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. Oh, now, in that moment, what is Mephibosheth thinking? He's thinking the king's summons is his death warrant. But what choice did he have but come? Where would a guy like Mephibosheth hide from a guy like David? Verse 6, David said, "Mephibosheth," for the first time his name is spoken. "At your service," he replied. The king quickly reassures him, "Don't be afraid," verse 7, "for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table." Mephibosheth arrives at the palace expecting one thing, but finding another. He never would have dreamed that he was there to be loved. But that's the nature of steadfast love. David guarantees land and provision for him. Verse 8, Mephibosheth bowed down and said, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?" Verse 9, then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's steward, and said to him, "I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandsons may be provided for." This means that David returns all of the land of Saul to the family of Mephibosheth, making him wealthy in an instant. He appoints Ziba to be the steward over the land, knowing Mephibosheth can't work the land himself. Finally, verse 12, Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. He was lame in both feet. Though society rejects him as broken and worthless, the king receives him as a son. Isn't that beautiful? Now, friends, David doesn't always offer us a model to follow in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, does he? In fact, over the next few weeks of our journey with David, the wheels start coming off David's wagon. It gets ugly. Brace yourself. By the time this story is over, we'll have found a man who has lied and looted and lusted. And it's not pretty. However, here in 2 Samuel 9, David does well, and we do well to follow him. David models that wonderful word, chesed. Writing about the word, Eugene Peterson notes, the Hebrew word chesed, narrowly translated love, is a large word. He says, no single word in our language is adequate to translate it, so we revert to the use of adjectives to bring out the distinctive quality and broad reach of this love. Steadfast love, loyal love, covenantal love. What we're after is an understanding that retains the affections and desire and intimacy that commonly go with love as we sometimes experience it as parents and children, lovers and friends. But amalgamated now with the stability, dependability, unswerving commitment, and steady reliability that we so commonly find wanting in ourselves and others. Chesed is often used in the biblical revelation to designate God's love. But we humans, who have been created in the image of God, are also capable of loving this way, even though we never seem to get very good at it. Chesed is love without regard to shifting circumstances, hormones, emotional states, and personal convenience. This is the kind of love with which God so loved the world. Chesed. Say that with me. Chesed. Chesed is steadfast love. It's covenant love. And we don't see it modeled for us very often. Tim Keller writes about the difference between covenant love and consumer love. In consumer relationships with a retailer, you say, I'll be in this relationship with you as long as you give me good merchandise at a fair price. And if you stop giving me good merchandise at a fair price, I'll go to another retailer, right? That's how most of us shop. In other words, in a consumer relationship, you sacrifice the relationship to meet your needs because your needs are more important than the relationship with the retailer. However, in a covenant relationship, you sacrifice your immediate needs for the good of the relationship. You serve and maintain the relationship even when it's not meeting your needs. That's covenant love. That's chesed. Now, Keller notes, and I think he's right on here, increasingly, our personal relationships are being shaped by our retail relationships. We conduct our personal relationships with our neighbors, our friends, our church, the way we conduct it with a retailer. The relationship is disposable because the individual's need is more important. No wonder we're so lonely. This is becoming more and more true of friendship. This is becoming more and more true of marriage. Marriage is no longer a covenant. It's a business arrangement. It's quid pro quo. Till death do us part, or until you stop meeting my needs adequately. Either one. One relationship in our society which is still largely viewed as covenantal is the relationship between parent and child. There's no quid pro quo between parent and child, not a young child. I've felt this personally in my life. My oldest daughter, Emma Kate, is 12. When Emma was one, this is a picture of Emma when she was 1 year old. It was January 04. This little girl came down with a terrible stomach flu. We weathered several days of what must have been the worst sickness in the history of humanity. But there was one moment in particular during those days that I will never forget. I was holding Emma next to my chest. The poor little baby had just got sick all over her clothes. So for just a few moments, I was holding her in my arms with no clothing and no diaper. Now, you're probably picking up on the ominous foreshadowing, right? You guessed it. She got sick all over me. When I say she got sick, I mean that sickness launched from every orifice of her little body. Onto my arms, my hands, my clothes, my face. I had no idea someone so small could create so much devastation. I have never smelled anything so dreadful before or since. Now please note, while I'm drenched in defilement, Suzanne is literally curled up on the floor, cackling with laughter. That was the day clearly spoken of by the prophet Daniel when he wrote about the abomination that causes desolation. Now, in that moment, what if I would have had a transactional relationship with Emma Kate? What if I would have had a consumer relationship with her? Do any of us need to rethink the nature of our relationships? Do you need to reconsider the habits of your marriage or your interactions with friends? Now here as we see David showing steadfast love, covenant love to Mephibosheth, it would be very easy to take this message to say, love one another. And even love the unlovable with a steadfast love. But I don't think that's where we're supposed to go with this today. Because when I observe the unfailing love of David, I can't help but consider the unfailing love of a better known member of David's house, King Jesus. David's chesed offers us a beautiful illustration of God's chesed for us. Yes, in the Bible, that word is used to describe our love for one another, but 3 times to 1, it describes God's love for us. In fact, it is from God's character. The ancient Israelites define the word. That's why in verse 3, David seeks to show Mephibosheth God's unfailing love. Now, I want to show you a few things about God's unfailing love by looking at the Psalms. The Psalms are one of the best places to go to understand the nature of chesed. The word's used 246 times in the Old Testament. More than half of those times, it's found in the Psalms. By reading how David and the other psalmists describe God's unfailing love, we come to see how desperately we need to experience it for ourselves. Here are some examples. Psalm 25, verse 7. Do not remember the sins of my youth and my rebellious ways. According to your love, your chesed, remember me. For you, Lord, are good. Forgetting and remembering in Hebrew, that's not something done by accident. If God forgets something, it means he overlooks it. It means he ignores it. If God remembers something, it means he focuses on it. God's unfailing love teaches me that I can pray, God, forget my sins and remember your son. His unfailing love is forgiving. Psalm 6, verse 4, turn, Lord, and deliver me. Save me because of your unfailing love. Save me. Don't limit that word save to spiritual matters. The verb means help, rescue. Now hear me. God can save you from hell, but he can also save you from a bad decision or a bad relationship. And he'll do it because he loves you very, very much. Now, you may not have done anything to deserve his rescue, but neither did Emma Kate when she was spewing and pooing on me, right? Trust God's steadfast love. You hear me? Trust it, because it's greater than your mess. Psalm 31, verse 7. I will be glad and rejoice in your love, for you saw my affliction and knew the anguish of my soul. In his unfailing love, he sees our pain and turns toward us with empathy. Psalm 31, verse 21. Praise be to the Lord, for he showed me the wonders of his love when I was in a city under siege. Oh, this is fascinating. When you learn to recognize God's love for you, you'll shake your head and wonder at how marvelous it is, even in seasons in which you're surrounded by problems. Psalm 119, verse 76, may your unfailing love be my comfort according to your promise to your servant. His loving kindness can heal a broken heart and soothe an anxious soul. It brings comfort. Psalm 40, verse 11, do not withhold your mercy from me, Lord. May your love and faithfulness always protect me. Maybe you need God's protection. Maybe you need God's chesed to protect you, whether from an enemy or a bad habit. Hey, maybe you need God and his chesed to protect you from you. God's steadfast love protects, and it provides. Psalm 90, verse 14, satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. God's generous love brings provision, but it does more than just bring resources. When you personally experience it, you will find satisfaction for the longing of your soul. We've raced around trying to fill the hole in our souls with all kinds of things, most of them unhelpful, some of them destructive. An encounter with God's love leaves a soul satisfied. There's provision, there's protection. When David invited Mephibosheth to his table, he was making a promise. In the ancient world, having a seat at the table meant you were afforded protection and provision from the head of the household. Think how welcomed that change would be for Mephibosheth, who's known only hiding and hatred since childhood. What a privilege to be invited to sit at the table of a king. But you were invited to the table of the Lord. In his covenant love, he saved you a seat. And that seat represents a promise. Of course, you didn't earn it any more than Mephibosheth did. But that's okay, because seats at this table are never earned, only given. Let's say you feel unworthy. You feel unlovable. Because you've really screwed up. Or you're just really screwed up. It's okay. He's saving you a seat. You're invited to the table of the Lord. Maybe the reason you feel unlovable is because, just like Mephibosheth, you were dropped. You're damaged. It's not your fault, but you were damaged, and you don't feel worthy of the king's court. Well, he's got a seat right next to him. You're invited to the table of the Lord. Maybe you don't want a seat at the table. Because you don't want to sit at the table with a God who'd let you get dropped. Let's stop right there and let that sink in. That's true for a lot of us. We're angry. If you're angry at God for allowing you to be dropped, would you just take a moment and feel your feelings? Be honest with yourself. God knows anyway. But as you reflect on your anger, test it. Can you really trust it? All those years in hiding, I imagine David's name was hated among the servants of Saul who raised Mephibosheth. So from age 5, I suspect he was told that David was to blame for his family's ill fortune. All his life, he heard how horrible David was, how terrible David was, how wicked David was. But contrary to everything he'd ever believed about David, the king wasn't the problem. He was the solution. He was the hope of healing and restoration. Test your anger. Check your perspective. Is there any possibility you may not be looking at it right? Maybe you just need to be reminded. Maybe you just need to be reminded how much God loves you. One thing you can guarantee about God is he will be much more committed to you than you will be to him. The scriptures make that very, very clear. He will be much more committed to you than you will be to him. Do you need to just remember how much he loves you? I think some of us needed to remember to be reminded today. I know very well some of you didn't. In fact, some people in this room right now walk the earth every day with a sense of God's love for them. It's amazing. You know who you are. You didn't need this message. But now I need you to help me with the rest of us. When we come together as a community, we help each other find faith. That's what a community does. Knowing that in a church like ours, we're all in different places on this spiritual journey, and frankly, we're all in different seasons of life. And for you, maybe the wheels are coming off your wagon, and you're not so sure about all this love. Well, that's where the rest of us are going to come in and help you. There's an old liturgy that has been used by the people of God for many, many centuries. And it's a liturgy called a litany. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it's where a leader or a worshiper, someone at the front, would state a phrase. The congregants would all respond together. The scriptures are filled with litanies, particularly the Psalms. And I'd like to read a litany with your help. There's one phrase that is repeated again and again through the Psalms for the congregation to respond to. And here's what the phrase is. His love, his chesed, endures forever. Say that with me. His love endures forever. I want to walk you through Psalm 136. I am going to read the first part of the verse. You will all together respond with these words. His love endures forever. Now, I warn you up front. I have not unpacked the psalm with you. We will read some verses and you'll say, how does that show that his love endures forever? Well, I assure you, to the people of God, when they wrote this and when they first started singing this, it absolutely did, because it confirmed things in their history and it reminded them God is up to something and God does have a plan for them and God is going to protect them from people who want them dead. But today, just let the experience speak to you. And as you listen, you know what? Here's the truth. Some of us need to just sit and listen to the hundreds of people in this room tell you his love endures forever. Be reminded. Some of us, in our confession, will build our faith. Psalm 136, verse 1. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. Give thanks to the God of gods. Give thanks to the Lord of lords. His love to him who alone does great wonders, who by his understanding made the heavens, who spread out the earth upon the waters, who made the great lights, the sun to govern the day, the moon and stars to govern the night, to him who struck down the firstborn of Egypt and brought Israel out from among them with a mighty hand and outstretched arm, to him who divided the Red Sea asunder and brought Israel through the midst of it, but swept Pharaoh and his army into the Red Sea, to him who led his people through the wilderness, to him who struck down great kings and killed mighty kings, Sihon king of the Amorites and Og king of Bashan, and gave their land as an inheritance, an inheritance to his servant Israel. He remembered us in our low estate and freed us from our enemies. He gives food to every creature. Give thanks to the God of heaven. You believe it? I want to do that with one more psalm. This is a much shorter psalm. I want you to stand with me. And I want to take you to the first four verses of Psalm 119. Now, you know your line. Here's what I'm going to ask. Say it like you believe it with all your heart. Say it like you believe it with everything in you. Verse 1, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. Let Israel say. Let the house of Aaron say. Let those who fear the Lord say. Let those who are looking for work say. Let those who are looking for love say. Let those who ache with grief say. Let those who struggle with depression say. His love, his steadfast, reliable love endures forever. I would like to invite our band to join me because we're going to end our time together by receiving communion. The song I've asked them to share with us today is one that has become something of a favorite of our community in the last few months. It's a song about coming to the table of the Lord. And I will say to you, come to him. If you've blown it, come. If you've been rejected by everyone else and nobody wants you at their table, come. If you're tired of pleasing people, if you're tired of disappointing people, if you're just tired, come. Come to the table of the Lord. And when we receive communion, we remember how great this love of our God is, that he'd go to such great lengths to make our problem his problem, so that we could be restored to relationship with him. That's what communion is about, the sacrifice of Jesus for our sins. But as you eat the bread and drink the cup today, remember whose bread that is that you're eating. You're invited to the table of the Lord. And remember, when you come, when you sit at that table, there is an explicit promise. Oh, everyone knows. He's your host. He will take care of you. Maybe you need to come and search for healing. Maybe you need to come and search for peace. Oh my word, how many of you need to come and search for direction? Wisdom. Insight. Oh God. Come. Come. If for some of you, I know we're all in different places on the journey, and I love that about our church. I love that there's so many people from all different backgrounds, and we're all just learning to do life in Jesus together. But I don't know, on your journey, you may be at a place of making a decision. And some of us need that. You know your own soul. Some of us need that moment where we just make a decision, an intentional decision. No, I'm coming. I'm sitting down at the table of the Lord. Maybe this act of communion is your way of saying that to God and receiving His love for you. If you're new to our community, or you come from a background, you just simply like to observe us do that, when the trays come by, just pass it on to the next person. We won't think anything of it, and I mean that. And please make yourself at home here today as we meet together. But I'd ask all of you to hold on to the bread and the cup for a few moments until we get to the end of this song, because we want to receive this together. Open your hearts to God. Let Him speak to you in these moments. His love endures forever. Now I want to give you a little homework. Teacher's been away for a couple weeks. You know how homework works around capital. You only need to do it if it helps you love God and love others more. Try it and see. Here's a psalm for the week, Psalm 36. In an earlier iteration of this message, we were thinking about using Psalm 36 in the sermon, but I'm telling you, it's probably worth your time this week. The psalm begins almost like a lament, with David sick and tired of the drama and deceit and devastation caused by difficult people. Any of you there? But the second half of the psalm, in the second half of the psalm, David clings to God's chesed and he finds faith in a storm. Check out Psalm 36. I want to share with you a document that we've created that is available online. You can get it on our online bulletin. You can get it through social media. I've made a list of every verse in the Psalms in which that word chesed shows up. Sometimes it's translated love. Sometimes it's translated faithfulness. Sometimes it's translated kindness. Look for it. We've got it highlighted in this list of verses. It's a PDF. You can download it. And some of you have found things like this to be very helpful for you devotionally. Look at each verse. Some of the verses will inspire you to go back and look at the psalm in its entirety. See if God has something for you here to teach you about His steadfast covenant love for you. I warn you, I didn't edit this down. It really is every verse in the Psalms that has the word chesed in it. Sometimes you'll read these verses and you'll say, "What?" They might freak you out a little bit. You can handle it. See what God speaks to you. Also, sometimes we recommend music. Here's a good thing. I'm not going to recommend a song. Let me recommend a whole album. Chris Tomlin, this last year, released this album, Love Ran Red. Two of the songs that we sang today are from that album. And for some of you, music just has a way. Music just has a way of speaking. And music has a way of... You carry it with you. You carry it with you throughout the day as you hum the tune or think about it in your mind. Pick up this album. Finally, two things. Psalm 36, verse 7, a verse to take with you. How priceless is your unfailing love, O God. People take refuge in the shadow of your wings. I love that metaphor. This is available online. If you'd like to take it. I know a lot of you are putting it on your phones and putting it on your computer screens, that graphic. Finally, you're invited to the table of the Lord. You could take this graphic with you as well. As the service comes to an end, we're going to have people standing here at the front ready to pray for you. If you'd like to receive prayer, make your way up here and invite them to do so. My blessing, my benediction for all of you is this. May you find the faith to come to the table, pull up a chair, and be served by the unfailing love of God. Thanks for being here. Grace and peace.